For an aspiring designer, the best thing that you can do is just sketch, sketch, sketch. If it's life drawing, whatever it happens to be, because the skill of a designer is to be able to take an idea, a concept that is nothing but words, but then be able to articulate it, draw it, present it to a group of people, leadership, whoever that may be. So all of a sudden, those just general words become something tangible.
Hello and welcome to the CDE podcast. Today, we're speaking with Phil Zak. He's the Global Executive Design Director at Chevrolet.
Hello, Phil. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Ah, fantastic. Thanks for the invitation.
Nice to be back in Germany. You've got quite a lot of history with this country.
Yeah, it's fantastic to be back, actually. As a young designer working in GM, I was here in 1990 timeframe. And then actually, 2007, 2009, I ran Opel Exteriors, director for that. And so had a fabulous time when I was here. Got a lot of travel, the European experience. Really nice to come back.
Are you going to make a little bit of a holiday of it while you're here?
Yeah, actually, my wife and I, she was working at GM at the time, so we were both up here. And as soon as she heard I was flying out here for this event, it's like, well, I'm going as well. So we were tacking on a few extra days and traveling out to Wiesbaden and enjoying the sights.
Oh, beautiful. I'd like to talk by discussing your upbringing or background as a designer. Where are you from originally, and how far back can you trace your passion for automotive and design?
How far back? Well, first of all, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, so still Midwest USA. I was drawing trucks since I was 2 years old. So I know my mom still, she had given me drawings that I have done. Always fascinated with trucks. Went to high school, you know, did a lot. Art programs, also good in math and science. So I think that helps me a lot as I kind of integrate and talk with engineers and kind of understand their world as well. So that's been really helpful. I ended up going to the Cleveland Institute of Art, which, you know, obviously it's in Cleveland just based on the name. But my initial direction was not necessarily automotive design because I didn't know the career actually existed. So I was just going in for illustration. When I was in high school, I used to always draw, it's kind of ironic, Camaros, Corvettes, just for fun, airbrush renderings and the lot. So I went to the Cleveland Institute of Art to go for illustration. I figured that's what I'd be doing. First 2 years, you take life drawing, foundation glasses, painting. And then your third, fourth, and fifth year, you get into your major. So I ended up, one day went through the department, and they were doing chainsaws. And I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. Industrial design. I enjoy things that are mechanical. I enjoy taking things apart. I would always work on my car. And I like to draw. So those three interests came together. And then when I was in the industrial design department, GM would send representatives, designers, to the class on Saturdays for a Saturday class. So I signed up for that class, got to, you know, some internships as I was in school, interned at GM. You know, they also had a lot of portfolio reviews with other auto manufacturers. But at the end of the day, I chose GM and started in, 1988. It's been a little while. But I always say I owe my automotive career to chainsaws because that's what really got me into the ID department and got me moving forward.
That explains all the sharp teeth at the front of all your cars. I get it now.
Oh, not all of them, just some of them. But
when I spoke to Eduardo Ramirez of Hyundai, he also started out in more general art before realizing that automotive was the direction he wanted to go in. Of course, there now are bespoke undergraduate automotive design courses, and there might be students who go straight into that course without doing more general stuff first. Do you think there is value in just doing art first and then moving into automotive?
There's value, whatever the process is, it's based on, you know, the student, how much time they want to invest, but there is always an investment in just doing art. I tell people that my life drawing classes made me a better automotive designer because when you're starting life drawing, you're just worried about the gesture of the figure. You're not worried about details, shoulders, hands. First, you want to get the gesture of what they're doing, and then you go from coarse to fine, and then you work in the details. So automotive design is really very similar to it. At first, you want to get the gesture of the vehicle. What does it want to be? Does it want to be low cab forward, high back? What emotive do you want that sketch to have? And then that's where just the more free thinking sketching from life drawing came in. And then you dial it in from there. So I always recommend life drawing. Any other kind of drawing you can do just makes you a better automotive designer. And then I'd say contrary, if you can really sketch a car well in an environment, you can also pretty much sketch anything. So it's kind of hand in hand.
It's all good practice, isn't it? And actually, human bodies, hands and all that, really hard to draw. If you can get those intricacies, I think you're going to find everything else pretty straightforward from there in terms of your sketching abilities, aren't you?
Oh, 100%. That's exactly it.
I'm interested in what some of the cars are that really inspired you growing up. You mentioned lots of trucks, lots of Chevys and Corvettes. I mean, it would be those growing up in Ohio, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for the most part, there was a variety. I never really gravitated towards the luxury end of the spectrum. I was always more on kind of the sport performance end of the spectrum. So Camaros were there. There were some Corvettes that I had seen that really inspired me. C4s in particularly, especially when GM came out with the C4 Corvettes. That was just inspirational. It was clean, interior was high tech. There was a lot to really like about it. I liked the progression forward. So that was a little bit more of my high school days, but that was something that really stuck with me as far as something that is new and different.
Without getting ahead of myself, does it ever wear off the fact that you've gotten to contribute a chapter to this American icon that you worshipped growing up, or is that still surreal to think about?
It's still a bit surreal to think about, and I'd almost just rather keep it that way, as I'm just the passion of every day, just getting in the studio, working with the team. It's new, it's challenging, it's fresh, but, I never take it for granted, but I just always want to just kind of keep the intensity up with that and the intensity up with the team.
If you think about it too much, you'd be afraid to make any bold decisions, right? You're sort of just going to get your head down and treat it like another project.
A little bit like that. I mean, just generally when I'm doing any car, it's you try to just look forward. What's next? Where do you go? What feels right? And just keep working that direction. Yes, the history's there. The heritage is there. It's all in the back of your mind, but you don't let it guide where you want to go in the future, because at the end of the day, it still needs to be fresh, contemporary, and relevant for the next group of young buyers that are coming through. So just keep pushing the envelope with the team.
Absolutely. I believe you're a GM company man. You've been around a bunch of the brands, as with many of the higher-ups at GM who've pretty much done their whole career there. What was your very first role in terms of automotive design?
My first role when I started the company was in Cadillac, actually. They used to rotate designers around, which is a good plan. I think about every 6 months that we'd go to a different location just to get to understand that brand. And then, I think I was with the company for 2 years and then was tapped on the shoulder to see if I'd want to go to Opel. Experience was fantastic. I'd want to kind of experience Europe, experience the culture, the perspective on vehicles. And, you know, I took that. Funny story, one point, because Chuck Jordan was running the vice president for the company. And he said, well, you know, if you want to go to Opel, you know, chances are we're not going to send your wife. It's like, well, that's okay. We talked. You know, I'd go for a couple, she'd come in for a couple months, and then there'd just be a couple months that I'd, you know, come back. But towards the end, he's like, we thought about it. We're just going to send you both, so you don't have to worry about anything. So that was really fantastic for both of us, because we just got, you know, the experience here. And then again, it was easy to come back for the second time to kind of work with the team at Opel.
Absolutely. And aside from the sort of cultural enrichment, what do you feel you brought back to the States from your time in Europe as a designer?
As a designer, it's a different way. The proportions of vehicle size, the usage was totally different from the size of a vehicle in the U.S. So you just put a different, we'll say, set of lenses on when you look at a vehicle. It's analyzing it for the market, the customer, you know, where you start there, and then you work on you know, the design exploration afterwards, but always know who your customer is, what it needs to be, and what they are in need of. And then you try to answer that question.
It feels like GM are really pushing hard on electric vehicles, and among American brands seems to be one of the more successful in that regard so far. My impression from afar is that American customers are more hesitant about going electric than perhaps the average European customer at this moment in time. How important is great design to ingratiating electric vehicles to the American population?
Yeah. I'd say electric vehicles in the U.S. are starting to uptick. There's been a little bit more, we'll say, hesitation versus maybe the European market. But Cadillac going full electric has been very successful. So we're really starting to move on that. The Chevrolet Equinox that we've launched is doing tremendous in the market right now. Silverado EV, our electric truck, is starting to gain ground. Truck buyers are a little bit more difficult to maybe sway on the electrification side. And then the Blazer EV is doing well. We've got a performance variant of that, the Blazer EV SS, which has, you know, about 650 horsepower, all-wheel drive. It's really, back to the performance side, it's really fun to drive. Gets along quickly.
It's interesting to me that some GM brands like Chevy are leaning on heritage nameplates for their electric vehicles and designing them in a way that sort of nods to the past of those nameplates. And then other brands like Cadillac are coming out with new nameplates and really, really mixing things up in terms of their design language. What are the pros and the cons of those two approaches as far as introducing electric vehicles into your lineup?
From the Chevrolet side, we have so much brand equity in the names that we have and the personas that we have. So it made sense for us to really continue with that as we go forward. You know, not to speak too much on the Cadillac side, but you know, the brand reinvention, the moving that forward, the moving to electrification, everything was really new. So it was really a great time to really reinvigorate and then, you know, reestablish where the brand is headed. And it's been really successful for them to the date here.
The other day in North London, a C2 Corvette drove past me, which is a pretty rare sight in London. And for me, that's maybe the most beautiful American car of all time. And I just think it feels to me that now more than ever, if you're a brand with illustrious history, it's useful to tap into that history when there's so many new brands showing up that have none, and that's a differentiating factor. Does that inform your design choices these days? Are you tempted to lean more on the past, or is that a kind of, I don't know, is that sort of like a cheap trick, do you think?
We like to lean on the past from the standpoint of you take the heritage of what's there and how do you move it into a new direction. What we do not want to do is do a vehicle that relies too much on history, then it just becomes a little bit more retro and nostalgic. And that really doesn't reach a new customer. So, you know, what we're doing this year, and I think some of the stuff that we've done with the UK team here, with working on their Corvette concept, it's been a really nice way to take a look at the historic portion of Corvette, the chime line through the body, the muscular fender shapes, what you just mentioned on the C2. How do you take essence of that, but move it into a new provocative space? And I think they've done that. And then you'll see a couple other vehicles in the next few months from Chevrolet, from Corvette, that will start to lean into what we're thinking about where we're going to take the car.
What like?
Can't tell you right now.
Yeah, it was worth a try. Let's talk about the E-Ray.
Patience.
Okay. I just can't wait. Corvette E-Ray, that's a pretty big deal. This is the first ever hybrid Corvette. What's the process been like of realizing that vehicle? I guess it's been nerve-wracking, potentially, doing something so radical.
The Corvette E-Ray, it is our first. It's a performance hybrid. So essentially what that means is we have the Stingray 6.2 liter V8 in the back, which is about 495 horsepower. And the front axles have an electric motor, which is 160 horsepower. So total, it's about 655 horsepower that really moves the vehicle along quite well. But before I can really talk about E-Ray, because that's the third model that we've got out on the Corvette line. So the Stingray, which was the reinvention of Corvette, that's the eighth generation, That went to mid-engine. So our C7s were front engine, rear drive, long hood. So that was kind of more the traditional touring package, very much like the C2 that you mentioned. So the history is there. As we got into the C8, we couldn't make the C7 any faster. So we took the motor, put it over the rear wheels so that that weight's over the rear wheel for propulsion. And that's where the Stingray came in. So that is more driver's center line of vehicle, fantastic handling, fantastic turn in. So that was a Stingray. Then the second model we launched was we call the wide body, which it's about 80 millimeters wider for the larger wheels and tires that has our 5.5 liter flat plane crank motor. So that again just gives Corvette another perspective and a little bit more exotic feel. And then, as I mentioned, the E-Ray, the third one along, is kind of more of our touring model. It still has that wide body construction, look and feel. It's aggressive, and it's also that performance hybrid.
I thought it was really impressive how unmistakably Corvette the C8 came out, given that you moved to a mid-engined setup. It must be so daunting working on a nameplate like that. We were speaking to some VW designers recently who were involved in the Golf project, and they talk about the weight of this history and the fact that there's a percentage of the fan base who will not like it the second it arrives simply because it's not the thing that came before it. Do you have to just kind of trust your instincts and believe that over the passage of time, your work will be understood for its merits? I mean, the mid-engine C8 Corvette, I think, was a hit pretty quickly, wasn't it? Despite the huge change you made to it.
Oh, it's been the C8's been a tremendous hit, but it's ironic because we had that same issue. You know, when purists saw the car, it's like, it can't be a Corvette. It's not front engine, rear drive. But the more that they had seen the benefits of it and the more that they realized how much better of a vehicle it is, they have also embraced it. Yes, people still love the C7, C6 all the way down, and those are fantastic as well. But this just sets, again, the new direction for Corvette. Some brands evolve. We tend to do maybe a little bit more revolutionary changes for each model cycle. And that's what our customers like. And it just keeps us a little bit more open and progressive in the design execution.
It really seems that way. Again, such an iconic nameplate. And if you compare generations of Corvette to generations of Porsche 911, it's fair to say that one has changed more radically over time than the other. Is that exciting as a designer, just having this opportunity to really rethink an icon and rip up the rule book?
Oh, it's exciting as a designer. It's challenging as a designer. And you go through many iterations. Corvette is a passion for the designers. It's a passion for leadership. It's a passion for everyone at the company. So you also get a lot of help as you're going along. So it's a lot of great work, but it's also a lot of challenging. And then, you know, work with the engineering team as well. The challenge is there because it needs to look great, but it also needs to have that performance to go with it. So we're always working the vehicle hand in hand for aerodynamics, functionality, acceleration. It's a fantastic project.
And I imagine it's really enjoyable building a package for that monstrous V8, especially knowing that there's not going to be that many more of them in the future. But you, of course, also have the Ultium platform, which underpins all the EVs. What's it like working with a bespoke EV platform like Ultium? Is that a really freeing starting point for a designer?
If you're referring to some of the concept work that we've done on Corvette, the electrification that we're doing, the stuff we're rolling out, we're taking that approach as a little bit more conceptual. Again, our Ultium package is fantastic for what it's doing for vehicles like the Blazer EV, Equinox, Silverado EV. But as we do any concept, we like to break away from what we know today and then just really challenge the organization going forward, challenging the battery team, challenging the engineering team, challenging the aerodynamics team, as well as, you know, packaging. So while the Corvette concepts that we have, conceptually, we're kind of moving forward with the electrification. We're still working on the packaging and what it could be as we move forward.
We'll do a separate episode where we speak to Dominic about his Corvette concept, which is an absolutely unbelievable piece of design. Not a leading question, but I get the impression there are intentions for that project. It's not just designed for design's sake, is it?
it's not design for design's sake. It's looking at what we could do going forward with Corvette. How do we keep, you know, the essence of Corvette is a chime line through the side, the wheel arches, the muscular, you know, shape and form that were in the C2 that you mentioned that really originated from the 59 Stingray. How do we re-envision that going forward? So that's where Dom and team, and then the North American team has a vehicle, and California has one that we're going to release shortly. We're getting those out just to give a hint to the public of, you know, what we're thinking as we progress C8s down the road.
It's interesting, this model you have where you've got HQ and then you have these kind of crack squads around the world, these agile, small teams of designers. What's the advantage of that model? What do you gain from having teams like Dom's team in the UK? I guess there's just a kind of agility, a speed that they can have when they're that small that you can't have when you're a gigantic company.
Yeah, speed is part of it, but I can tell you the team in Warren also works really quickly, as does the team in California. Really, what we want is a different, unique perspective. So basically, the project was kicked off, pulled a brief together with the Corvette team in Warren, and then we engaged Dominic and we engaged the team out in California with that same brief to say, hey, what would your perspective be? And we didn't over edit. You know, we met maybe once a month and just kind of directly talked about what felt like Corvette, what didn't feel like Corvette. And then they progressed the model. So what I didn't want to do is to spend, you know, too much time that all of a sudden the themes start to look the same. So I wanted to make sure that I gave all the teams, you know, time for free expression. And that's what they all had done.
Evidently, looking at that project,
They all look great, I can tell you that.
Oh, I'm excited to see it. Tricky question, but from your back catalog, do you have any special favorites, whether it's because of the end result or because the process of creating it was so enjoyable?
That's a good question, but also a hard question for me to answer, because I'm always looking forward on kind of what's next. Love working on the stuff we're doing now for the Corvette concepts. That's really kind of pushing the envelope on where we are with Corvette. So that's exciting here. Hey, vehicles like the Equinox EV, the Blazer EV, those have been fun to work on and rewarding seeing them forward. Probably one that is maybe not known that I'm proud of. Once we wrapped up C8, the Corvette team was actually given an assignment to do the Hummer H2. So that's a small fact that probably most people don't know, but the team put that vehicle together in from white sheet of paper, and I've never had this happen in my career before, that there are actually no restrictions. The brief was, we have the Ultium package. How do we show this in the most capable possible vehicle that we have and work with the leadership team? It's like, well, we'll do a Hummer because that is the ultimate vehicle for capability. So the team pulled that together from white sheet of paper in less than 9 months, done, designed, released, and out the door with engineering to start building. So that was really an exciting project that happened during COVID as well. So there were a lot of things that could have slowed us down, but didn't. We were having meetings in parking lots with masks, and it all came together really well. And the vehicle's been doing extremely well.
It's a crazy, crazy car, and it was a hell of a statement for GM to make, that Hummer. It's a fun car. It feels to me like a bedroom wall poster car, and you could sort of count on one hand how many EVs you could describe that way. Do you think it's important that we have electric cars like that in the electric future, cars that are just designed to make people excited?
Yes, I think it's one of those where we know EVs are efficient. We know they're, you know, they could be worked on small scale all the way through on the luxury side. But this was really exciting to do, show what EV capability could be from an off-road perspective. And it is a fun vehicle. It's the all-wheel steer. It's really tight. It handles small. The removable glass panels gives you that open-air feel. And to take that off-road in pure silence is just a different experience on its own. So you really can, if you're into off-roading and you're into camping, you know, you can do it silently, and is that what that's what an electric platform gives you?
How good is silent off-roading? And then getting to run a large campsite off the vehicle when you get there is the best.
Oh, exactly.
Last couple of things, Phil. Is there a teacher, mentor, designer from your early years of your career that you look back on who was especially instrumental, who taught you something really valuable?
Well, that's a good question. Not one in particular, but I would say all the leaders that I've worked for, you've kind of learned something from each one. Some of them have been from the standpoint of how to engage with people. Some have been on the standpoint of how you work with the program team. So there's a lot that I would say I would go back and, you know, for anyone into the business, just know that, you know, the teams that you work with, even your peers, a lot of times your peers will challenge you to kind of go beyond what you normally would do. You just need to be open and make sure you take inputs from all those around you, because the influence will kind of mold you into a better designer.
Mm. Final question. What would be your golden piece of advice to young aspiring designers, whether they're still in their studies or just looking for their first job in the industry?
Good question. I'd say for an aspiring designer, the best thing that you can do is just sketch, sketch, sketch. If it's life drawing, whatever it happens to be, because the skill of a designer is to be able to take an idea, a concept that is nothing but words, but then be able to articulate it, draw it, present it to a group of people, leadership, whoever that may be. So all of a sudden, those just general words become something tangible that people can now embrace what that idea is and kind of come along for the ride and kind of help sell and support it. So it's how you think, it's how you can communicate. And again, the end is how you can take all of that, put it in paper in a 2D form, a video form, and then sell it so it can get beyond just an idea.
And also draw, draw, draw. I think there's definitely something in just getting your repetitions in with your craft so that when inspiration hits, you're at the ready and you've got that muscle memory there.
100%. You're not good after your first drawing. We always used to say like 10,000 drawings. So the best way to get there is start now and just continue to draw.
Phil, it was a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure myself.
Thank you so much for listening to this CDE podcast. Please like and subscribe to discover new episodes and upcoming events.